Early on the morning of Thursday, May 8, 1902, on the Caribbean island of Martinique, in the town of St. Pierre, on the northern coast, this town of approximately 25,000 people was going about their business as usual, much the way we do on a very normal weekday morning. For weeks, the volcanic mountain, Mount Pelee, had been making a lot of funny noises. Most of the people had grown quite complacent with the sounds that it made, and they had gotten used to it. They had ignored the noise, and they went about their daily routines. Some of the local people had noticed some increased activity of insects and snakes that seemed to kind of filter down from the mountain and kind of create a nuisance, but for the most part, all this was being ignored. The workers at the foot of the mountain at this distillery went to work as normal that particular day. The local telegraph operator was sending a message to Fort de France informing them that there were no new developments with the volcano when suddenly the line went dead. Most of the 25,000 people in that town were killed instantly. And from the expressions on their faces when they examined the ruins, these people never knew what hit them. They were killed instantly. Others suffered agonizing, painful deaths from the fire, the ash, the sulfur from the volcano. Of the thousands in that town, two people escaped with their lives. A prisoner in a poorly ventilated prison and a little girl who was badly burned and unable to get to a lifeboat. There had been numerous signs in this town, but they all were ignored. And what I would like to talk about for a little while this morning is a biblical account of a man that did much the same thing. He ignored all the signs much the same way these people ignored the signs of that volcano. They went about their daily routines, they ignored all the signs, and they felt like that it won't happen to me. If you like to follow the reading, we're going to look at Acts chapter 23, and we're going to start with verse 11. Now the setting here is the Apostle Paul had been preaching, and he had been arrested for his preaching. He had been preaching Jesus. He talked about his conversion process. And in this prison, it says in 23 and verse 11, it says, "The following night the Lord stood by him and said, 'Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.'" Now keep that in mind. We're going to revisit this verse and the facts of it in a little while. Verse 12, when it was day, the Jews made a plot. They were going to kill Paul. And some of them made an oath that they were neither going to drink or eat till they had put him to death. There was about 40 of them who made this plot. And as they made the plot and they discussed it, verse 16 says, the son of Paul's sister heard about the ambush. He went into the barracks and told Paul about the plot that was going on to kill him. Paul called the centurion and he says, "Take this young man to the tribunal." Now, your translation may say the commanding officer, or he wanted this man to explain the plot that was going on. And as the account goes on, they took him. He explained to the commanding officer the plot that was underfoot to kill Paul. We come to verse 23, and the commanding officer called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night." Now that's 9 o'clock at night. Now this is a lot of soldiers for one guy that they're guarding. But they provided mounts for Paul to ride, and they're sending him to Felix, the governor. So this was a big deal. This was a lot of horsemen, a lot of spearmen. They put Paul on a horse. and they're attempting to save his life. They send him as far as verse 31, and to Patras, and then the next day they go as far as Caesarea. That's about a 60-mile trip, and they do this over the space of that night and then the next day. And then it's there in Caesarea, verse 24 and verse 1. It says, after 5 days, the high priest, Ananias, they found out that they've sent him up to Caesarea, about 60 miles away. Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. Now your translation may say an orator or a lawyer. Basically, this guy was a hired gun. He was a fancy lawyer, and I don't know if you watch court TV. I kind of like to watch some of the court TVs and the proceeding, but this guy was a high-powered lawyer that these Jews had brought down to argue their case, and they were prepared. They brought this lawyer. He comes before the governor. Now, this was a big deal. You've got the governor, you've got the high priest, you've got the centurions, you've got the Romans, you've got this lawyer, you've got the Apostle Paul. And the lawyer starts in with his case. And you know how lawyers talk. They start with their opening comments. And you've always got to lay out the flowery language, you know, in the opening statements. And he does so. And he talks about Paul. And he says in verse 5, he says, we have found this man a plague. The meaning of that word, if you look at the root and the etymology of the word, he's a pest. He's like a black plague upon the people, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple. And all the Jews joined in the charges and all this stuff that's going on. And then the governor gives Paul the opportunity to respond to the charges, and he does. And he says, verse 12, and they didn't find me disputing with anyone or stirring up the crowd, either in the temple or the synagogues. They can't prove these things. And he indicates in verse 14, he says, this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets. And he goes on to indicate in verse 16, I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. And he defends himself. And as we come to verse 22, it says, Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case. So basically, all these people are hoping for some kind of action against the Apostle Paul. And what does the governor do? He puts them off. Now, Felix, the governor, is your typical... I shouldn't say that. I started to say he's your typical politician. He goes in to office with a modest position and comes out a rich man. And he is a guy that is not a good guy either. He is a guy that is corrupt to the core. And he is a person that is not a good person. And it's a situation where, as we go down through the account, Felix puts them off for a reason. It says in verse 24, after some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. Now, you may be getting the idea that maybe he is a religious person. Don't. I get the idea Felix is not a religious person. Felix is a guy that's out for what? Felix is a guy that's out for Felix. He's out for number one. He's thinking about, what can I do today to better my state? What can I do to impress people about me and the Roman situation? But after some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and with his wife, who was understanding the Jewish religion, he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he, Paul, reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed. Now, that's the English Standard Version
of that particular word, alarm. The real meaning of the word is more than alarmed. The King James does it most correctly. It says he was, I believe, terrified, doesn't it? He was terrified. This is a guy that's all about number one. And he is listening to Paul talk about the coming judgment. He's just talking about judgment day. He's talking about a day when Felix will not be all about Felix. He's talking about a day when Felix is going to stand before Jehovah God and give an account for the things that he's done while on earth. And Felix is going to have to answer for the money he's stole, the lies that he's told, the way that he's lived his life. And all of a sudden, Felix is not so convinced that Felix is in good situation. Felix is now concerned. Yes, he's still concerned about Felix, but he's not concerned about the money. And maybe he is concerned about the money. He'd like to give it back or anything else that he's done wrong. He's concerned about his what? He's concerned about his soul. He ain't concerned about his riches. He ain't concerned about his prestige. He ain't concerned about who he can impress. He ain't concerned about his horses or his chariots or his palace. He is concerned about his soul and standing before Jehovah God. He is terrified. And what does he say? The English Standard Version that I'm using right here says, "When I get an opportunity, I'll summon you." But I still like the way the King James says it. "When I have a more convenient opportunity, convenient season, I'll send for you." Let me ask you, when would that convenient time be? I don't have a convenient time to talk about all the things that I've done wrong. I don't like to talk about the things I've goofed up. I never want to hear about the things I've done wrong. I don't want to hear about it. Verse 26, it says, "At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him." Now, there's the motivating factor for him sending for Paul to begin with and keeping Paul in prison. He hoped that money would be given him by Paul, so he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. Now, here's a secondary lesson I want to share with you. What about that verse where the Lord stood by Paul and he says, "You're going to Rome. You're going to testify about me in Rome." Remember that? Acts 23 and verse 11. And now what happens? 2 years elapsed. He leaves him in prison and Paul's thinking, "Well, Lord, you told me that I'm going to go to Rome. 2 years and here I am rotting in this prison. Did you break your promise?" Did he? No. He went to Rome. But what if that had been you? What if you'd been sitting there in that situation? 2 years goes by. You know what I'm thinking? He forgot me. He forgot all about that promise he made to me. 2 years goes by and here I am. He stood right there. I know it. It wasn't a dream. The Lord stood there and he told me, "You're going to Rome." And I thought, man, that's going to be fun. I like Rome. They've got some pretty architecture there, and it's going to be fun. I'm going to have a big time. They got good food there, too. I'm going to have a good time. That's going to be a great tour. The Lord told me I'm going to Rome. 2 years goes by, and what? I'm in prison. Am I in prison for doing bad things? No, I'm in prison for preaching Jesus. God's forgotten me. He acted like he had a plan for me and he's forgotten me. But he went to Rome, didn't he? That's the secondary lesson. Don't rush God's plan. The main thing, though, that we're talking about is, when is it a convenient season? When is it convenient? That's what Felix indicated. When is it a convenient time? I got a question for you this morning, and then the lesson's going to be yours. When is it a convenient time
to talk about the fact that our relationship may not be right with the Lord if it's not. When is it a convenient time? I don't know that it ever is. It's not for me. I don't want to talk about it. Did the fact that Felix sent Paul away change the fact that he would face God in judgment? I don't want to talk about it. Talk to the hand, don't talk to me. Did that change the fact that it's going to exist? That it's going to happen? Doesn't change it a bit, does it? It's still going to happen. Hebrews 9:27. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes the judgment. It's going to happen. Just as sure as there is a tomorrow. You ever look forward to an event? I mean, you're looking forward to it a lot. And you think, I'm just going to put it out of my mind. And you put it out of your mind, and you get busy living, and what happens? Before you know it, it's here. It's here. That's where we got the saying that a teapot, what is it? A watch pot never boils or something like that. You watch it, and it's never going to happen. You turn your microwave on, and if you watch that microwave, even if you put it on, I'm in a hurry sometimes in the mornings, put the microwave on for that little old instant thing you do for breakfast, you know, and if you watch that timer, it ain't going to go off. If you get busy and do something else and make your coffee, it'll be done like that. And that's the way living life really does. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. I'm going to give you one you really need. Now, this is a verse that you need, especially as you get older. This is one that I have used on Bobby because it's scriptural. Do you ever groan at home? Sometimes you don't groan as much at church, but at home you kind of groan a little bit and your spouse gets on to you. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. I'm going to let you know if you groan, it is scriptural and it's okay. It's okay. Yes, you know where I'm going, don't you, Larry? You're laughing already. For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, it's talking about our body getting old. If it's destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Now, pay close attention. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on the heavenly dwelling. If you groan as you get older because you just don't feel good and you're kind of getting older, you've grown a little, that's scriptural. I hear a couple of you laughing. It's scriptural. It says it right there, don't it? It says it. So it's okay to groan. So use it. Use it if you need it. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, what? There it is again. We groan. It's okay to groan. And this is a great, great passage. And you go down and read verse 7, we walk by faith, not by sight. But look at verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Goodness. That's enough to make you tremble, isn't it? When we face the judgment of God after this life is over, we either face it on our own or with the blood of Jesus Christ and our lives covering our sin. That's just the way it is. So my question for all of us this morning, is there ever a convenient time? Just like that day in Mount Pierre on Martinique. It would not have been convenient on that Thursday morning to tell your children, you're not going to school, I'm not going to work, we're poor, this is our home, but we're going to run away. That wouldn't have been convenient, would it? Change your whole way of life. You're poor, but yet you take your kids out of school and you take everything, you put it on your back that you can, and you just start running. you just start running. You might escape with the clothes on your back, but you escape with your life. And maybe you make it out of the burn zone, and maybe you don't. That wouldn't have been convenient, would it? But you know what? You might have been alive. You might have saved your physical life. That wouldn't have been convenient at all. This morning, what is convenient? This morning, if you've never become a Christian, what more convenient time is there than today? You know, one of the things in this church that we have done, we built a building, we've got climate control, we've got a baptistry. Can it get any easier? We don't go down the river or nothing. When you become a Christian, we do everything we can to make it convenient for you. What more convenient time? If you've become a Christian and you've been baptized, and you don't even know if it's for the right reason. In Acts 19, Paul came to Ephesus and he found some believers. And it was obvious from their discussion, they didn't know why they were baptized. It was obvious they were baptized for the wrong reason. What did they do? They said, what we need to do here today is we will have a debate. We will debate whether baptism is for forgiveness of sins or not. On one side we have the Apostle Paul, and the other side we have those that think baptism is not for forgiveness of sins. Is that what they did? Huh? Of course not. They said, we will be baptized again. There was no debate. There was no argument. There was no discussion. They just said, we will do it. Too much is at stake. Was it convenient? I don't know if it was convenient for them or not. It wasn't about convenience. It was about what's important, what is at risk, and what is the right thing to do. It's never convenient. It's only right or wrong. What if we've not been living a life that's faithful to the Lord? Is it convenient to stand up for right and say no to sin? Probably not. But you know what? It sure will be easier on the day of judgment. It sure will. If you need the prayers of the church, if you need to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, if you're not sure about your salvation, that's too big a risk. Don't run chances with your salvation. The Bible's full of situations where they were sure of what they wanted to do to be saved, and they made sure of their salvation. Every Sunday morning and most Sunday nights, we offer an invitation to make sure that if people need to respond to the invitation, they have that convenient time to do so. And we'll offer that this morning as we stand and sing.